Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats. We'd like to welcome you to the Archives Records, D.C., 2010, the joint annual meeting of the Council of State Archivists, the National Association of Government Archives and Records Administrators, and the Society of American Archivists. Please be seated, and please welcome to the stage Mark Mandel, the Public Records Administrator for the District of Columbia.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
As a public records administrator for the District of Columbia, I serve as both the chief records officer as well as the state archivist. It's my great pleasure and an honor to serve as the host to welcome this esteemed event to the District of Columbia. I hope you're all enjoying our cool fall weather. I have here a letter of greeting from our mayor, the Honorable Adrian M. Fenty. Before I get to that, I just do want to mention, let me ask a question. Is the District of Columbia a state, a county, or a city? The answer is yes. So we're about 600,000 people. The government is about 35,000 employees and over 60 agencies. And we share a lot of the same issues that you all do, but we have some unique ones because of our special relationship to the federal government and the fact that we're a state, a county, and a city all rolled into one. I'll be doing a presentation Saturday morning along with Val Woods from King County. Washington. We'll be doing lessons learned, and you can hear more about our plans here in D.C. So I'd like to read an excerpt from the letter from Mr. Fenty. This event will afford the opportunity to discuss innovative approaches to archives and records management challenges. As you gather to share ideas, we appreciate and look forward to your continued efforts to safeguard and preserve our nation's records. So on behalf of the residents of the District of Columbia, the Executive Office of the Mayor, the Office of the Secretary, Dr. Stephanie Scott, you have our best wishes for an enjoyable event. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Peter Gottlieb, President of the Society of American Archivists. Thank you for attending this joint annual meeting. On behalf of my counterparts at COSA and NAGARA, Pat Michaelis and Tracy Brzezinski, we're delighted that the Archivist of the United States, David Ferriero, has agreed to keynote our opening session. We'd like to begin by standing on ceremony for just a few minutes. As we've all come to understand, putting on a conference like this is a monumental task. I have the pleasure today of introducing our colleagues who made this joint meeting possible. The 2010 Program Committee, co-chaired by Jelaine Chubb and Ben Primer, did a capital job of encouraging the submission of session proposals on which this conference was built. They were joined in the effort of selecting from among some 145 proposals by a dynamic and diverse group of individuals. I would ask each 2010 program committee member to stand when I read his or her name and remain standing until all can be recognized. Please hold your applause until all are standing. Co-chair Jelaine Chubb, the brand new State Archivist of Texas. Co-chair Ben Primer of Princeton University. Nancy Fortna of the National Archives and Records Administration. Ann Jenks, State Historical Society of North Dakota. Diane Kaplan, Yale University. Tony Kurtz, Western Washington University. Tara Laver, Louisiana State University, Baton Rouge. Kay Lanning Minshew, Troup County, Georgia Historical Society and Archives. Wayne Moore, Tennessee State Library and Archives. Carol Prieto, Daughters of Charity. Jennifer Martinez Wormser, Sherman Library and Gardens, and serving ex officio as co-chairs of the 2011 SAA Annual Meeting in Chicago, Richard Marciano and Nancy McGovern. Please join me in thanking our 2010 Program Committee for their outstanding efforts. And now I'll turn it over to COSA President Pat Michaelis.
Thank you, Peter. Speaking of monumental tasks, how does one convince a couple thousand archivists and records managers to visit the nation's capital, which we know was built on a swamp, during the hottest, steamiest month of the year? Well, you give the task to some locals who know their way around and hope that the hotel's air conditioning doesn't fail. Host committee co-chairs Sharmila Bacha and Jim Corbis and their very enthusiastic committee members did a great job of compiling interesting repository tours and preparing the conference website lots and lots of information about Washington so that you could plan to make the most of your time here. I would ask each 2010 host committee member to stand when I read her or his name and remain standing until all can be recognized. Please hold your applause until all are standing. Co-chair Sharmila Bacha of the National Archives and Records Administration, co-chair Jim Corbis of the Office of the Architect of the Capitol, Rita Kakis, William Carpenter, and David McMillan of the National Archives and Records Administration, Patrice Davis, Defense Logistics Agency, Karen Fishman and Nora Yeh, Library of Congress, Susan McElrath, American University, William Jordan Patty, George Mason University, and Rachel Woody, Smithsonian Institution. Please join us in thanking our 2010 host committee for their enthusiasm. And now a few words from NAGARA President Tracy Berezanski.
An important aspect of our organization's individual and joint conferences is our opportunity to learn from our industry partners, many of whom will be exhibiting in the Capitol Idea Exhibit Hall beginning this evening. We thank them for their support and are particularly grateful for several partners for their sponsorship of various activities throughout this conference. We thank our silver sponsor, Atlas Systems, as well as Ex Libris, Hollinger Metal Edge, and Preservation Technologies for their support. And now on to our plenary speaker. David S. Ferriero was confirmed as 10th Archivist of the United States on November 6, 2009. Previously, he served as the Andrew W. Mellon Director of the New York Public Libraries and in top positions at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Duke University. He's quick to point out that his career began in the stacks at MIT under the tutelage of Helen Samuels. He's certainly come a long way, and now you can follow his adventures on his aptly named blog, Collector in Chief. Please join me in hailing to the chief, David Ferriero.
Thank you all. And just to set the record straight, I was at MIT before Helen arrived. I beat her, I believe, by 7 years. I started in 65. She came later. But I did learn a whole lot from her. So it's a special honor to be addressing so many archivists and records administrators from across the United States. And I'd like to say a special thank you to the presidents and executive directors of the three organizations, Pat Michaelis, Tracy Brzezinski, Peter Gottlieb, Nancy Beaumont, Steve Grandin, and Vicki Walsh, for their efforts to welcome me to my new job. Their honesty, passion, and guidance has been invaluable to me. I also want to congratulate all the members of these organizations who have worked to make this such a great meeting. And I also want to give a special shout out to the 992 of you who came to my house last night. And especially those of you who dropped $4,200 in my gift shop. So please come back and spend some more. I have been archivist for about 8 months now, and I'm still having a great time, despite being called before Congress at least 7 times and having at least 2 more hearings in the wings. And I must say, being in the line of fire as members of Congress take shots at one another is a totally new experience for me. Last year at this conference, we celebrated the 75th anniversary of the National Archives, and this year we celebrate the 75th anniversary of the Society of American Archivists. We've come a long way over those 75 years, yet in some ways we're facing many of the same challenges. The first head of the National Archives, Robert Diggs Wimberly Connor. Dr. Connor was a native of Wilson, North Carolina, a graduate and history faculty member at the University of North Carolina. One of his first acts was to commission a study on the state of the government's records. Describing the situation from the perspective of the researcher, he writes, "Conditions make it impossible for officials to find adequate room for both their files and their staffs. Few facilities can be furnished the student, and his presence is tolerated rather than encouraged by staffs already sufficiently burdened with the routine duties of the day. He finds the records he desires to use scattered throughout the country, stored wherever space can be found for them, in cellars and sub-cellars, under terraces and over boiler rooms, in attics and corridors, piled in dumps on floors and packed into alcoves, abandoned car barns, storage warehouses, deserted theaters, or ancient but more humble edifices that should long ago have served their last useful purpose. Typical is the case of valuable records relating to Indian affairs, which were found in a depository in Washington, piled on dust-covered shelves, mingled higgledy-piggledy with empty whiskey bottles and with rags and other highly inflammable trash. In another Washington depository packed with documents, the most prominent object which meets the eye as one enters the room is the skull of a cat protruding from under a pile of valuable records. I think it is a fair question that if a cat with 9 lives to risk in the cause of history could not survive the conditions of research in the depositories of government records, can we justly blame the poor scholar who has but 1 life to give for his country if he refuses to take the risk? Connor and his colleagues created systems for records management, accessioning, processing, preserving, and encouraging use. They cleaned out the whiskey bottles and put out the cat. They brought order to the chaos just as the storm of records grew into a tempest. As early as December 1935, records began to arrive at the archives building, and by June 1941, over 300,000 cubic feet were on file. 8 years later, the space in the building was exhausted, and by the mid-1940s, 1 million cubic feet of federal records were being created each year. It is almost inconceivable, U.S. Archivist Wayne Grover observed in 1953, that the federal government in the 22 years from 1930 to 1952 should have created more than 7 times as many records as it did during its previous 155 years of history. Before my confirmation, I read most of RDW's speeches, thanks to my friends at Chapel Hill, and I find myself taking guidance from his thoughts as I face a task similar to his. The state of electronic records in the federal government today is much like the state of paper records faced by Archivist Connor. We may not have whiskey bottles and dead cats, but we do have Trojan horses and viruses and a volume of records that strains the imagination. The Bush White House alone deposited over 77 terabytes of electronic records. Like Archivist Connor, we're faced with the challenge of not knowing the volume of electronic records in the federal government and not knowing the conditions in which they are stored. Our first survey of how federal agencies are managing electronic records was not reassuring. 80% of the agencies reported that their electronic records were at moderate to severe risk. We are at risk of having a 20-year gap in our history because we failed to properly manage and preserve the electronic records that document that period. Almost two decades ago, Richard Cox, in his book, Archivists, Archival Institutions, and Electronic Records, argued that technological innovation was changing the way information was created and used within organizations. He suggested that archivists needed to change the way they do business in order to adequately respond to those organizational changes. A decade later, he extended this idea with an examination of how management programs to reinvent or re-engineer organizations pose further challenges to archivists. We must change the way we do business if we're going to be able to manage electronic records in the federal government. Our survey of agency vulnerabilities was the beginning of changing the way we work with agencies to help them manage their electronic records. We're reaching out to agencies to help them assess their weaknesses and to find ways to confront them. One step in that process is getting the agency chief information officers talking to the records managers. I was surprised to learn that the CIO Council and the Records Management Council had never met together. I will be co-hosting the first joint meeting of these two groups next month at the National Archives with the Chief Information Council Chair Vivek Kundra, the nation's Chief Information Officer. We also need to turn our attention inward. The National Archives should lead by example in managing electronic records, and I intend to see that we do that. The National Archives has been in the electronic records business for a long time. We started preserving electronic records in 1968. National Archives staff like Tom Brown and Peggy Adams are frequently cited in the professional literature for their leadership. Our attention then was focused on what we used to call machine-readable data. These statistical data sets and later databases most often produced by the Federal Statistical System. We were in the forefront on those complicated data sets, but we got left behind on other kinds of electronic records. Two laws govern the National Archives, the Federal Records Act and the Presidential Records Act. Through action by the courts, the Presidential Records Act recognized electronic office records as records around 1996. We have all of the emails from the Reagan White House. However, the Federal Records Act has yet to change. For federal records, we still live in a world of print and file. The first bill to address electronic records in the Federal Records Act is still languishing in Congress. Perhaps the largest undertaking in the history of the National Archives is the creation of the Electronic Records Archive, or ERA. Established in partnership with the private sector and developed using the best available research from around the world, ERA is intended to preserve and provide access to any type of electronic record created by a federal agency. The ERA got off to a rocky start, but we have stayed the course and progress has been steady. ERA as a functioning system is within sight. The system will be complete by the end of 2012. The ERA, however, is not the end of the road. It will provide the archives with a system to manage all existing record schedules, to create and track new schedules for paper and electronic records, as well as a storage and retrieval system for federal electronic records once they're deposited with us. It will not provide agencies with a way to manage their electronic records internally, and we need to help them figure that out. The fundamental nature of information has changed, and the ERA was developed within the same framework as that developed by R.D.W. Conner and his colleagues. Confronted by limited space, an overwhelming volume of records in desperate need of preservation, Conner and his staff devised a system that saves only 3 to 5% of the information created, a system that identifies records hierarchically, papers of officials within agencies, within departments. Contrast that, however, with the recent acquisition of the Twitter archives by the Library of Congress. They're preserving all of the tweets ever created. And I should say that when I heard about that, I called Laura Campbell at the Library of Congress to remind her that those federal tweets are mine. To which she responded, "Come and get them." It is not because there is value in every tweet, but rather because in the aggregate, it will tell us something about our culture. The library readily acknowledges that they do not have today the tools to analyze those tweets, but they are confident that those tools will be developed. We're fortunate to have the Presidential Records Act that forces us to keep all presidential records. As a result, we now have over 200 million emails from the most recent Bush administration. The volume and complexity of presidential electronic records provides a valuable testbed for developing new methods of identifying and retrieving those records. I can guarantee you that we're going to have to find a better way to deal with those emails than print and read. I believe that when the records of the Obama administration are compiled, the official documents, the emails, the blogs and Twitters and Facebook walls, we will have the corpus of information to allow future researchers to examine what it was like to be within that administration. Like the tweets at the Library of Congress, we do not have the tools to do that analysis today, but we will preserve the raw materials for future researchers. One of the less well-known byproducts of the ERA project has been our involvement in research tools for managing and reading electronic records. We do not have a research and development budget. However, from the beginning, we've used funding from the ERA account and invested those monies in coordinated research with leading research agencies throughout the Federal Networking and Information Technology Research and Development Program. This has led to collaboration with some of the most innovative research being conducted at places like the Army Research Laboratory in Maryland, the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at the University of Illinois, and more recently, the School of Information and Library Science at the University of North Carolina, and Chapel Hill's Renaissance Computing Institute, which draws on talents of seven universities and institutions in North Carolina, including Duke, UNC, and NC State. The Society of American Archivists recognized the excellence of this group at UNC in 2008 with the presentation of the J. Franklin Jameson Archival Advocacy Award. Without the involvement of the National Archives, federal information technology research would not be focusing on tools that are useful to archivists. Last year, we formalized our research activities by creating a new unit called the National Archives Center for Advanced Systems and Technologies, or NCAST. Ken Thibodeau is directing that group, and they will focus on how to move cutting-edge research in computer technology, applied linguistics, into tools that can be used by archivists. Some of those tools are available for you to use today. The National Archives of Great Britain developed Droids, software that will tell you what software created a particular file. NCAST and the Army Research Center are developing novel methods which today identify over 70 file types not recognized by Droids. These results and developments will ultimately be incorporated into Droids. Droids, however, just shows us how to unlock the box. It doesn't tell us anything about what's inside the box. In a separate project with Georgia Tech, we're developing software that will identify what types of record we have opened. Is it a letter? Is it a memo? Is it a document associated with a nomination? Or is it a commendation? This is the first step towards an intelligent system that can look into those 200 million emails and weed out the lunch dates and give us ones that deal with policy. Last month, the National Archives delivered to the Senate over 170,000 pages of records from the Clinton Library for the Elena Kagan confirmation hearings. We did this in record time, but we did it with brute force. 16 archivists, 6 archival technicians, and a supervisory archivist put in over 6,000 hours on the job, working every Saturday and Sunday and Memorial Day. I hope that some of these tools will be ready for the next nomination. Another tool available to you today is IRODS, which stands for Integrated Rule Oriented Data System. IRODS is another example of how our research collaboration is serving the broader archival community. This year, the IRODS Users Group meeting, a group of researchers presented initial results from the Distributed Custodial Archival Preservation Environments, DCAPE, a project funded by the National Historical Publications and Records Commission. DCAPE develops a framework to support institution-specific preservation policies while providing the economy of scale needed for cost-effective services. DCAPE relies on IRODS to implement those institutional-specific rules. Electronic records are just one of the challenges facing the National Archives. When I arrived last winter, I found an agency in need of a culture change to be able to exist and thrive in the digital age. The National Archives needs to be more nimble. It needs to take risks in trying new approaches to record keeping, and it needs to make smarter and more creative use of technology. The President's Open Government Initiative has given us the encouragement and the authority to make these changes in the archives culture while pursuing the President's goals of more transparency, more collaboration, and more public participation in government. The goal of the President's initiative is to transform the relationship between the government and the people, but it has other aims too, as the President said last year. Quote, openness will strengthen our democracy and promote efficiency and effectiveness in government, unquote. What the President wants with his Open Government Initiative is what we at the Archives also want, as expressed in our mission statement and strategic goals. Open government is the essence of the work we do every day. It's rooted in the belief that citizens have the right to examine and learn from the records of their government. This will equip them to make informed decisions in the future. Ready access to the records of our nation has always been what the National Archives is all about, but we must open up more, and we will, to provide access to ever more complex records in a digital world, and we have made our intentions clear in our open government plan. Some of you have criticized my use of the term citizen archivist. I think you may not understand my intent, so let me share with you what I mean by citizen archivist. I've worked my entire life in research libraries, and one of the constants across all of those institutions, including in the National Archives, is that we let researchers walk out with valuable information about our collections without leaving any of it behind. I've seen firsthand the benefits of tapping those resources. The National Archives needs to capture the knowledge created by our researchers so that it is readily accessible to the next generation of researchers. To do that, we have to make it easy for the researcher to deposit that knowledge and easy for the next researcher to find it. We've started a conversation with our constituents through our public blogs and public meetings, and it's clear from those venues that our researchers are eager to contribute. It's now incumbent upon us to create the mechanisms to make that contribution happen. Internally, we're using Web 2.0 tools to foster discussions. As you may have heard, we've been instructed by the OMB to prepare a 2012 budget that is 10% below our 2011 budget, and then to prepare a second one that is 15% below the 2011 budget. In July, we set up a forum in IdeaScale to allow the staff of the National Archives to participate in the discussions of how we should achieve these savings. I've also created a transformation task force charged with identifying the key issues, barriers, and opportunities for organizational effectiveness facing the National Archives today, and to recommend strategies that position us to flourish and lead in the future. Physics has taught us that what once appeared chaotic is often quite orderly when viewed through the appropriate lens. We're fortunate to live in a time when grinding that new lens is called for. It is difficult work, and it takes talents of a community of scholars to make it happen, and I welcome each and every one of you to join us in these dialogues through the web or through the medium of your choice to chart this new course. Thank you for joining me today, and we have time for some questions. So you have free rein to ask anything that you want to ask, anything that's on your mind about anything, whether I mentioned it or not, and I will tell you anything I know after 8 months on the job. One of the questions I get a lot is, what has surprised you? You know, what have you in your 8 months? What surprised you the most? One of the things that I'm daily stunned by is the depth and diversity of the records that are in my custody. 44 facilities around the country, 13 presidential libraries, wonderful, wonderful collections, and I get an opportunity to, you know, ask questions of my staff about do we have, or, you know, every time I visit one of those facilities, I get to see stuff. We have a facility in San Bruno, California. Two weekends ago, I was there to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the immigration station on Angel Island. We have all the immigration files in San Bruno. Also in San Bruno, we have the inmate files from Alcatraz, and I had Al Capone's inmate file in my hands, for instance. And also some wonderful audio files of inmate interrogations from Alcatraz. And I'm still laughing about one that I heard about this poor guy who took croutons out of the mess hall and was pleading not to be thrown into solitary confinement. Croutons. First of all, that they were serving croutons at Alcatraz. I've been fortunate enough to work in now three institutions that had Walt Whitman ties in one way or another: Duke University, New York Public Library, and now the National Archives. And, you know, this is a commemoration of the Civil War at the National Archives, and so I got interested in what we might have around Walt Whitman, since he did work for the government. He worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, so I asked to see his personnel record. And in that personnel record is a 5-page letter of recommendation from Ralph Waldo Emerson. Every day is like this, you know. It's just amazing, absolutely amazing. Questions?
Yes, I'd like to ask a question. In the news recently, the way in which the National Archives reaches many of us locally and statewide is through the inadequately funded but marvelously imaginative NHPRC, and the recent decision of the House not to consider, as I understand it, it's they've put off indefinitely the discussion of the reauthorization of the NHPRC. Have I misread that? Okay, are they, so what is going to be the fate of the NHPRC, which affects us way outside of the walls of any of the archives' own buildings?
If I have anything to do about it, it's going to live forever, and it's going to increase in funding. But that's, one of the best parts of my job is to finally be on the other side. After all these years, I'm now in a position to be giving money away instead of asking for it. And that's one of the great joys of my new life. There are people who are not supporting NHPRC. One of those, you know, miserable hearings that I just talked about was around NHPRC. And this is another situation, a good example of how we were caught in the crossfire of the tension between the majority and the minority. The minority was prepared. They had actually listed NHPRC on a website called UCUT and asked for people to vote on cutting NHPRC funding, totally cutting the total funding. 10,000 votes they got for cutting NHPRC. 10,000 people who had no idea what NHPRC was. I can guarantee that. So we're kind of caught in the middle on this, but this authorization is safe, as far as I know. And you have the word of the archivist that he's going to fight not only to keep it where it is, but to increase the funding for it. I'm also, you know about PAR also, that another bill that's working its way, not working actually, but there are bills to $20 million level, $10 million level, to provide the same kind of support that I'm also very much in favor of. I've been making the argument on the NHPRC side about new skills, that these grants provide opportunities for people to learn new skills, create work, the whole job thing. I've been using every kind of angle I can on it. And I come and I go to Hill offices armed with data about that the staff has prepared for me about the impact that those grants have made in individual states. So I had an opportunity to meet with the story I like to tell is my visit with Susan Collins from Maine, who had some questions about funding. And I brought with me a list of about 300 institutions in Maine who had been supported in one way or another by the by grants, armed with a copy of a book published by a Maine publisher, written by a Maine author, based on the Sewell Family Records, a boat building company in Maine, whose records are at the Maine Maritime Museum, the organization of those records funded by NHPRC. So I had a lot of stuff. She loved it. She took one look at that list and identified the fact that many of them were very small institutions, and it was the only way that they were going to get the kind of support they needed to do that work. And she turned around. So it's telling those stories that works.
Hi. I'll wait for that. So I know that the National Archives, and you especially, have been doing a lot of outreach to the public using Web 2.0 and other internet media. And I was wondering, what has been the most enjoyable aspect of that for you, and what do you hope to see in the future with that?
The most enjoyable aspect of it, I think, is... I have a new mantra that I'm exercising in the agency called "Yes until No." That means just go and do it, and don't go through all the permissions and bureaucracy. And social media is a wonderful example, because I've got a great staff who has wonderful creative ideas, and just letting people go and run with it, and leading by example. So using tools, using new tools, experimenting, risk-taking, all that kind of stuff that I talked about are incredibly important for the National Archives to be doing, because we're supposed to be leading the rest of the government. We're supposed to be advising them on their use of social media. And we can't do that unless we're experimenting and using them ourselves so that we understand the implications, the records implications of this new media. I was not pleased. I hadn't started work yet. I hadn't been confirmed yet. But I was not pleased in September when I read about the White House letting an RFP for advice on archiving their social media. Because I said to myself, wait a minute, that's my job. Or I hope it's going to be my job. So the ulterior motive here is to get the agency thinking about using these new tools and anticipating what's coming down the pike and what the agencies are going to be using. And I think the staff is pretty excited about the opportunity to experiment with these things. And I'm having a great time with the blog myself. Let me just tell you how this works. As I'm discovering things, about what we have and what we're doing, I have weekly meetings with two of my social media folks, and we sit and talk about what's going on, and we toss around ideas, and from that comes a theme for the blog. And I find that one of the best meetings that I have every week. I just love that opportunity. Half an hour on Tuesday morning to sit down and talk about what I've discovered, what I'm thinking about. The next one, you think about records and records and records. We have a guy who we sent to Afghanistan to study how the records of war are being created and maintained in the field. My next blog is going to be about war records. So it's stuff like that that I love.
My name is Rick Barry, and I wanted to offer a softball. Might be the last year that you get softballs.
Yeah, I know.
I wanted to say thank you for a really wonderful reception last night on part of National Archives. And especially to the foundation for the National Archives. It financed that, and that also financed in large part the public vault, which is a magnificent addition to the NARA's resources and to the public's resources. And finally, to offer an unsolicited pitch for the foundation. So I think that most people in our professional community don't know anything about it. And I would like to say I hope that all of us will consider it in our gifts, our favorite charities, as a terrific place to support the work that they do on behalf of all of us.
Thank you for mentioning the foundation, because that is an important part of how we fund a lot of the educational outreach and exhibit programs at the archives. They also run the shop, so that's why I'm pushing, you know, come and visit the shop and, you know, buy stuff. But you can also become a member of the foundation, a friend of the archives, and support the archives that way. So that is you know, another one of my responsibilities, is helping the foundation raise money to do the work that they do, which I'm also having a lot of fun with.
Yes, I was wondering or hoping that perhaps you could shed some insight or give us a sense of what the steps will be in resolving the situation with the Nixon Library that popped up in the news last weekend.
That didn't take long. Oh, boy. When I told you that there are two hearings in the wings, those two hearings in the wings are on presidential libraries. One about the process for creating a presidential library, and the other on, related to this, the relationship between the foundation, the Presidential Library Foundation, and the presidential library. So this is a situation which has had a rocky start from the very beginning in terms of the archives' role in the Nixon Library to begin with, because it came late into the fold. The library was already up, the museum was already up. We were sitting on the collection here in Washington while the drama played itself out there. So the director of the library was not happy with the Watergate exhibit that is in the opening museum when it opened. Didn't tell the story with the records. So he took it upon himself to, before my time, I want to make that clear, before my time, to create a new exhibit. Did a lot of wonderful oral histories with people who were directly involved in, and created a plan for a new exhibit. The missing piece, and the reason that the successful presidential libraries are successful, is that they have really good communication between the foundation and the library. And this is a case where we didn't have very good communication. So that's where we ended up, where we are. I have a meeting with that director Monday morning, as a matter of fact. So just picture this. I'm sitting in Reagan Airport Saturday morning with the New York Times in front of me, and I open it up, and I say to myself, oh, my God. That's how I found out about it. I was trained at the New York Public Library. You don't talk to that press unless you get clearance.
Good afternoon. I'm interested in hearing about the archives and its role in K-12 education and in supporting the use of primary sources in classrooms across the nation.
Something I care about passionately, something that I spent a lot of time starting at Duke University and then at the New York Public Library, figuring out ways to get our content, primary sources, into the hands and eyes of teachers and students. If you came to the exhibit last night, I mean, if you came to the archives last night, there was an opportunity for you to see something called Docs Teach, which is a new online facility that we've just created and about to launch that is intended to give online access to thousands and thousands of documents within our collections, along with lesson plans and the opportunity for teachers to work together on creating lesson plans that incorporate our content into their curriculum. We're also doing an amazing amount in the regional facilities with regional records along the same lines, not as digital as I would like to see it. But one of the agenda items for me that I've identified as I'm on this nationwide tour visiting all of my facilities to get to know my staff and figure out what's going on. We have lots of creative educational activities going on around the country, incredibly uncoordinated. We do not have an educational czar, educational program. These people don't even have an opportunity to get together and compare notes about what they're doing. So that's part of this transformation agenda that I mentioned, is to create that that structure within the archives.
I'm Mike Miller, and I have a question about records management. You did a very good, the National Archives did a very good study about survey of records management in the federal government last year, got good publication, had a lot of good information. What is your plan for doing something for this year? What would it cover? And do you have any ideas going out how you plan on carrying this forward?
Yeah, we've just... is Paul Wester here? What's the theme for this year's survey? Say that again.
Training.
That's right. It's needs assessment around training in the agencies. That's what the focus of this one is. Following up on what we learned about the state of archives of records in the electronic records in the agencies. One of the lessons I've learned in this process, which probably won't be a surprise to you, but it was similar to what I learned at Duke University when I became responsible for the creating the records management program there. Records, the responsibility for records management usually falls to the most junior person in the department. High turnover, not very well trained. Not a huge priority of the department head, for instance. And we have a similar situation here in the federal government where we have a variety of folks who are saddled with a responsibility for records management. And in fact, I discovered not too long ago that there is no job classification, job family within the federal government, records manager. So what do you expect? But that's another thing that we're working on.
Thank you. Allie Krebs, I have a question for you since you're talking about records management and you were discussing visiting facilities. Mm-hmm. And twice in your opening remarks you mentioned Indian Affairs. And so I'm wondering if you've had the opportunity to visit the American Indian Records Repository in Kansas, Lenexa, Kansas?
Not yet.
And if you would be able to comment at all about access to records there?
I have not been yet. I've done 16 of the 44 facilities.
Okay. Do you know about it at all yet? Or
no.
Okay.
Nope.
Let's talk later then. Thank
okay.
you.
Happy to talk. Dr. Paul Conway.
David,
You know that by volume or by any other measure, almost everything the 44 facilities that you're in charge of have is paper or flat or not digital.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about, beyond the commercial arrangements that have that were negotiated prior to your arrival, about ways to open up the collections through digitization creatively?
We're light years behind in terms of even thinking about that. And the only, you know, the only thing, concrete thing that I can point to that where we've had any progress is with those commercial arrangements. We've got some really creative folks who have some wonderful ideas around how we might address that. It's, you know, it's one of those things that's on the transformation agenda. Yeah. We have 10 billion pieces of paper, you know, and I would love to be able to have digital access to 10 billion items. That's my goal.
David.
Mr. EAD.
No. APP, I'm sorry. Given your background in research libraries, do you see your administration at NARA now as a chance for new forms of collaboration with the Library of Congress, for example? I mean, when I was at LC, I mean, there was this great wall that sort of existed somewhere the bottom of the Capitol between LC and NARA, and I'm hoping that that will go away.
Me too. And I've been, you know, I've been deliberate in focusing on in-house first. I have lots of friends in LC and in the Smithsonian, and I would add the Smithsonian into that mix too, because the three of us have incredibly talented staff. Have basically the same agenda, have the same kind of formats that we're dealing with, and it's ridiculous for us to be duplicating effort around what we're doing. So it certainly is a wonderful opportunity and something I'm looking forward to pushing on. I've had conversations with Smithsonian, conversations with LC. Lots of changes in the wind, you know. There.
To follow up on Paul's question, open access is one of the things that is of burning interest in the scholarly environment. Do you, with the commercial digitization agreements, they allow you to make free access of this material after a certain amount of time, 5 years. Do you envision the National Archives making the material that's been digitized by the commercial agencies available as soon as those 5 years are up? And on the NHPRC question, do you see something like the NIH requirements that where federally funded research has to be made freely available in some form as a requirement of receiving a grant?
Have not talked about that last one, but willing to look into that. I have not been involved in any conversations around that. On the first part, I'm not happy with the 5-year lock on the content. It has now become, you know, an industry standard. This is the way the commercial entities do their work. There's no way that I'm going to have the resources to do what they're doing, and this is one way to quickly get all of that done. I would love to be able to turn it on at the end of the 5 years. It's unclear to me what we get at the end of 5 years. Whether we get the raw data or we get the search engine or whether we have to replicate that ourselves. So that's what I'm concerned about right now. And I think I have 2 years to figure that out because that's when the first contract expires. It was the same situation, you know, at New York Public, I worked for 5 years with Google. And it was the same kind of lock on the content, restrictions on what we could do with it. So not my preferred mode of operation. So there's an area where the Smithsonian, the Library of Congress, and the National Archives could work together, since we have massive amounts of content that, that these folks want to perhaps influence that. Okay, I'm standing between you and the opening of the exhibits. Come and visit us physically or virtually, and stay tuned.
Thank you, David. Thank you for taking questions.